Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. As always, I'm your host, Liam Garrow. At the reins, pulling on the reins, grabbing on the reins of what hopefully is your favorite new show, Tell Me Everything, the show where fabulous, wonderful actors, writers, celebrities, bon vivants alike, come on the show and regale me, your, I will say, intrepid host. I don't even really know what intrepid means, but I'll work it in. I just want them to tell me everything about their favorite things in pop culture. And this week we have an absolute gem of a human being. He's a friend of mine, and he'll, after this, if he's not already, be a friend of yours, I'm sure. At least in your imaginations, which counts for something. Drew Droege, a wonderful actor, a writer, such a gifted, unique, interesting performer. You have seen him on shows like Search Party. You know his voice from, I mean, honestly, like every single fucking cartoon in the world. He's a wonderful, wonderful man. He also is in the throes right now of bringing his new play, Messy White Gaze, around town. They're doing stage readings. He's just the damn best. Everyone, I'm not going to make you wait any longer. Here is Drew Droege. Oh my God. Ooh, ooh, everyone. Wow. Drew Droege, can you believe we're on the mic? We're officially on the mic. And you're calling from a bunker, is that right?
Yes. My own little private bunker. It's lovely here. It's wonderful. I've got all that I need. I've got a little cup of black tea and your company, and that's all I need.
And would you describe this as a hostage situation, or are you feeling like you can come and go as you please?
Oh, very much. No, I'm very much under duress, but I'm used to podcasting, so it's easy for me. So I'm just only mildly panicking, and it's fine. It's all good.
I mean, so major, I'll say this too, that like your captors would allow you to set aside the hour to appear on a podcast.
Mm. Oh yeah. No, that's why. That's what they made me do. I have to do podcasts all day. All the time.
This is like your version of paying rent, I see. God,
I wish. Wouldn't it be great if we could actually pay rent by doing podcasts? I would not have to spend a dime.
If anything, the government would owe me.
Absolutely.
I'm doing so many dang podcasts. Justin Trudeau, you better cough it up, okay?
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
All five of our blue Canadian dollars, you know?
God, you say Justin Trudeau's name and I get so envious. I get so like, oh, right. That's right. That's who you all have over up there. Cool.
It's pretty incredible to have a federal leader who doesn't look like he's on the brink of death.
Yeah, I know. But I will have to, go on record and say I do think Biden is a wonderful president and I'm a huge fan.
As do I.
100%.
And listen,
I think he's done really great work, and I think that he's not getting credit for it, which is baffling to me. And he did things that, I mean, you know, he did things for Obama. He did things for, you know, like back in the day. He's a hero. He's a major. It's just, you know, we're just terrified. We're just terrified down here.
Yeah.
You know?
No, for sure. And also,
but
it's like
wholeheartedly campaigning and voting for him in November. No question about it. I'm not disappointed, but it's scary.
And Ms. Girl, not if, but when we'll manifest this, when he gets reelected, we need him to get through that second term. We need him to see the home stretch. We just really need that. You know what I mean?
We all need that.
So Joe, if you're listening, I know you're listening. Not unlike Drew, you're a non-time listener, constant time caller. I know you're listening to this, and we just, on behalf of everyone here at Tell Me Everything, we really want you to not only get reelected, we would famously also love it if you could live. So if you could do us that public service, we'd really appreciate it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, we normally gab at the top of the show before we, you know, sort of segue into our guest's delightful pop culture pulls. But let me say this to you, Mr. Drew Droege. Yours are so good. I actually said to my producer before we started recording, before you joined our fabulous little Riverside room, I was like, we need to start talking about this right away because I could go on about each of these topics for 3.5 hours.
Oh, great. I love it.
And so I actually want to be able to carve out the most time possible for you to tell me everything about it. And so I want to start with your first pop culture pick from the bowels of Hollywood. You've brought to us, I'm so obsessed. You brought this past year's Oscar ceremony, you brought the 96th annual Academy Awards and you wanted to talk about some of your favorite highlights. But first of all, I have to ask you this. Have you been like an Oscars watcher your entire life?
Where
you're
like, it's a point.
Yeah.
My entire life I've watched the Oscars and it's been something that when I was a kid, I would beg to stay up for.
Yes.
I'll never be more excited or delighted in my life about the Oscars. I even think, even if I was nominated or won an Oscar, I really think, I don't know that it could top when I was a kid and Silence of the Lambs swept, because it still is when you look at it, like it's like one of this like unprecedented, it would never win today. For several reasons, I know, but also with the weighted system, that stupid weighted system that they do, that make it impossible for movies like Silence of the Lambs to ever win again, I believe. But
yeah,
it was so special for a horror movie that I had seen a year before with my mom. My mom and I love to go to the movies, and we went and we saw that movie, and we're like, this is the best movie ever. For it to win Best Picture, and also for the two of them to win Actor and Actress and Best Director, and I was just like, I am in love with Hollywood tonight.
Yes.
And I think, I don't know that I'll ever be that. You know, there are years that I get very upset. Of course, the year that I got blackout drunk when Brokeback Mountain lost to Crash, and there are all these, I have moments that, yeah, I think about, like, I'm like, oh, wow. So this year was, for me, overall, like, meh. It was kind of, I have opinions.
I would love to know what they are.
The older I get, the more I'm kind of like, well, whatever. What are they going to do? But
well, and also, you know, listen, how have we not in 96 years figured out how to keep the ceremony to under 3 hours?
Thank you. I just watched the SAG Awards and the Indie Spirit Awards because those are the two that I vote in. Mm-hmm. And yes, they're streaming, so they had no commercials, but they got in and out in 2 hours.
Yeah.
And the Oscars was four, and it's, yeah, just like they would give out one award and then go back. There were so many commercials, so many commercial breaks. We didn't need all that. We didn't need the musical numbers were, other than I'm Just Ken, which was a masterpiece, which I thought was better than the movie.
Also, let me say this, might actually, I'm saying this seriously, go down in history as being like one of the great television moments ever. I'm just Ken, where I see love, she sees a friend. What will it take for her to see the man behind the tent and fight for me? I'm just Ken, and I'm your own, and I'm brave as the wind star. So hey, check me out, yeah, I'm just Ken. I agree, and I definitely think that, like, Ryan Gosling gets, like, major queer ally points for being like, because if it was his idea to be like, do this, like the iconic Marilyn Gentlemen Prefer Blondes number. That was his idea?
His idea.
Oh.
Doesn't that just make you wet? You'd be like, yeah, dude.
I almost slid off my fucking chair, you guys.
I know. I will shots fired, say I did not like Barbie. I was severely disappointed.
Wow, I guess you hate women. I guess you hate women.
That's literally what I've been called for a year, Leo.
Wow. Because
then I go, I just wanted to be at all surprised by any of it. I wanted to be entertained by any of it. And I really wasn't. But that number was better than anything in that movie, I thought, in my opinion, you know. And
it was incredible.
And I loved the art direction. I thought the art direction and production design in Barbie were wonderful, but it was not for me. So I was just sort of like not excited about any of the musical numbers happening. I even thought Billie Eilish and Phineas were great. Like, I thought their number was great. We don't need the Diane Warren Cheeto number.
I know. And here's the truth about the Oscars. First of all, famously never won a competitive Oscar. Finally was given an honorary one, I think, last year or the year prior.
Yeah, right.
But let me say this. The dirty little secret that no one wants to concede to with the Oscars is this. We all play favorites, and there are things we want to make space for on that show, and there are things we don't.
Yep.
And, you know, let's just be really real. We're there for, you know, we want to see great movies get awarded, and we're also there for starfuckery. So as quickly and as efficiently as we can get to the starfuckery, that's what we need to do.
Right. Well, and also it's just, there are things that it's just like how life isn't fair, this business isn't fair, it's maddening you know, Diane, I was going to say Diane Feinstein, another
great
person. Diane
another
Warren,
great Diane.
Yeah. The great Oscar loser, Diane Feinstein. No, Diane Warren is a mega talent, has made it, you know, and had, I think, much better chance in, you know, in the 80s, but just because of timing and the movies that she was involved in. You know, yeah, you want to give it to Diane Warren. My God, I voted for Annette Bening this year for this, because I love Annette Bening so much. Annette Bening is so good.
I know.
She's good.
Yeah.
Because every time she acts, she makes it look so natural and so real that it doesn't look like acting. And we give awards for most acting, not best acting. It happens and we give awards for most writing, not best writing. So anytime, sometimes a screenplay that jumps out and I see the words on the page, that's not good writing to me, but that often wins because people go, oh, that's good writing. I really heard those words. I really saw that actor. And so you're going to have someone like Diane Warren who, like, oh, she's great, but you're not going to vote for the hot flash, whatever that was.
Cheeto song. No.
You know, no. And Becky G and those, it was literally like, this is rough. This is not fun. I mean, you know, we've given words worse. Heart Out There for a Pimp, which was even more embarrassing for that to win for Crash.
Well,
but that's old white people thinking like, oh, this is what the kids listen to. Let's vote for that. That's when that happened. But yeah, you know, I feel like Glenn Close is another one that, like, oh my God, I cry every year that Glenn Close doesn't win. But it's just weird timing. I don't think you see the campaign is all around excited about somebody else. And
yeah,
you know,
well, and I think actually with the Oscars, the thing that's kind of tricky too, is like there does tend to be this sort of predetermined sense about what's going to happen. But before you even turn on the TV, like, I would say the only category that was really up in the air this year was Best Actress. It was like, it was maybe going to be Emma Stone or is maybe going to be Lily Gladstone.
Right.
And so that was really the only, and actually I would argue more oftentimes than not, that always is the toss up category where it's like, that's the one that everyone sort of is biting their nails over. And so you are also then again pulled into this like very long ceremony where then you are also watching the people that you already knew were going to win.
Yeah.
Like, it just seems so,
I know. And it's weird how things are so sewed up but also like I noticed like how the machine works. The closest I think I got when I was on the nominating committee for the SAG Awards like 10 years ago. And I was getting all this literature in the mail that was telling me what the top five, like these are the top five sort of contenders in each category. And I was like, wait, I thought that was my job. I'm part of the committee to pick the five.
Pick the top five, right.
But a lot of people that put on the committee don't pay attention. I watch everything that I'm not a member of the Academy, but I'm a member of SAG and I'm a member of Film Independent. And I watch everything that's nominated for all of those awards. I make it a job. With TV, I watch at least two episodes of every show. So I can at least give it a shot and go, I watched it. I hated it, but I watched it and I gave it a shot.
Because there's things
that I see that I go, I never heard of that. And then I'm like, oh, this is incredible. I loved it. But most people don't do that. Most people kind of go, oh, whatever. Oh, here are the five. So they just follow along. Because to me, like, the Best Actress category, I thought was very strong this year. I thought all five of them were good. I like Emma Stone. I think she's great. I just, unfortunately, for the two movies she has Oscars for, those aren't it for me. But I've liked her in other things a lot more. But no one was talking about Carey Mulligan in Maestro, which I thought was a phenomenal performance. That, you know, and I don't know. It's like that. Just the everyone was going after Bradley Cooper, and the whole narrative around Maestro was about Bradley Cooper wanting an Oscar. So like, it's all about what. It's like the movie. It's a campaign. It's all political.
Right.
If that movie is going to be about how badly this guy wants an Oscar. It's like, which I thought was so unfair to do to Bradley Cooper, because it's like, who doesn't want an Oscar? I mean, at that point, like, oh, I'm sorry. Like, I don't know. I find that strange. And
yeah, I think my thing with Maestro is, I'm going to say this. I thought it was a beautifully shot film. I think that film looks incredible. And I think Carey Mulligan also turns in a wonderful performance. I personally do not think Bradley Cooper is a great writer.
Mm.
And when we talk about being able to really notice the writing, I really noticed the writing in Maestro. And
all right, fair enough.
And I did feel, and I did feel like there were certain, I think also, and this is a very, I mean, and this is also very separate from the movie and just the actual quality of it, but you're so right that the way our perception of something else colors the movie. Because also, like, the thing that I find that must be so difficult for anyone promoting something on a larger scale, this means that they're not only doing all the talk show rounds, they're doing every single local news outlet, they're doing every single online outlet, they're doing videos all the time. Like, the media demand is bigger now than it ever has been, which of course means that you, two things. One, you are invariably going to repeat yourself.
Right.
Because there's only so many ways you can convey that you enjoyed working on something. How did this project come to you? Blah, blah, blah. But it also means that there now is more of an expanse and demand for more content, which means the onus, I think, is probably put on a Bradley Cooper, a Carey Mulligan, a whomever is promoting their project to keep talking, keep sharing, keep revealing, opening up, opening up, opening up, opening up. And I think because we live in a culture that is so quick to be cynical, and by the way, rightly so, wrongly so, I mean, you know, I offer that in as value neutral way as I can, but like, we're considering the way that we're wired societally, it is of course then going to be very difficult for an audience to hear that it took Bradley Cooper 6 years to learn how to conduct a 6 minute piece of music. Because we're going to, through the societal filter now that we've built, we're going to interpret that as cringe. And because we are deciding to make a judgment call that Bradley Cooper is cringe, we're now going to say that his movie Maestro is also cringe.
Yeah, it's really complicated. It's weird how we just decide. It's also weird how, like, we collectively have these opinions. Like, I mean, I'm telling you, by not liking Barbie, I was literally, there were dinner parties where I was screamed at by people. And I was like,
my God,
what's happened now? Like, we've decided collectively, like, this is good, this is not, or this is the thing. And I think, like, to be an actor in a film or to be a part of something and go, oh God, I have no idea. Like, is this the popular thing or is this not? Like, it's really wild. And then it's like, if you were into Oppenheimer, that meant you were against Barbie. Like, it was just these weird battles that people have that they're sort of like, because we're unhappy in our lives. I don't know that we can't see the movies just as what they are. I mean, because for me, like, I don't know. I get it. Like, I thought Lily Gladstone was phenomenal. I thought she was fantastic. And she should have won. I mean, she should have won. My problem with that was that movie. Like, I couldn't vote for that movie because I hated the way it ended. I found really offensive, and I wish the movie had been from her point of view. In an ideal world, Martin Scorsese would have produced it and would have found an indigenous woman to direct the film, or at least to tell the story and have Lily Gladstone as the lead in the movie, not dying in bed for the end, and certainly not having the old white man director giving the fate of that character in a radio speech at the end of that movie. That was truly one of the most upsetting endings of a movie. I left that movie and was like, oh, fuck this. I hate this movie. And it's a shame because I really enjoyed the first third of it. Like,
you know, me too.
So you're like kind of going, oh, I wish she would win, and it has nothing to do with her. Like, it's unfortunate. And it's also like, I get it. It's like, it just sucks that in 2024, we're like still taking baby steps with that kind of shit. We had such a reckoning about all this stuff, and it's like, we kind of are getting there, but we still can't let go. You know, and so I think it's like a lot of factors happen when people go to the ballot. I don't know, for whatever reason they do, and they kind of go, and I do think that I think that people really were behind Poor Things. They really just thought that that was like a smarter, a feminist,
I think it was also much more daring, and also much more daring movie. Like, I can really confidently say in my life, I've never seen a movie like Poor Things. Like, not to say that it hasn't explored similar themes, but I mean, if you look at it from a visual sense, if you're exploring and looking at what it's also exploring thematically, I mean, I think people perceived it as being a far more sort of inventive film.
Yes.
But I want to pick up on two things that you said, because I thought that was interesting. You know, this idea of when you're in the middle of something, like when you're a part of a project and you have this maybe preconceived sense of like, oh, is this going to be something? Is this not going to be something? I'm curious to know, Do you, and I wonder maybe if you're actually in the throes of this right now with these readings that you're doing for your new play, which we should absolutely talk about. But, you know, have you had those feelings in the middle of working on something when you were like, I think this is like good and I think this is going to be a thing?
Yes, I was on the TV reboot of Heathers, which I will still stand, though it was a masterpiece. It was just wildly misunderstood. And it was horribly timed and nobody saw it. I mean, it was on the Paramount app for a hot week or something. It was there for a minute, but it was something that was assuming that Hillary was going to be our president and that we could really make fun of liberal people in the way that the movie did in 1989. And we all of a sudden had Trump as a president. We were having school shootings every time this show was trying to end, and it was just poor timing, which I understood why the show was pulled, but it was something that was so daring and so smart. And I feel like that was, so we were all involved in that. And it was just that thing of like, wow, we're really saying, but I get frustrated very much that we should be further along. But I also understand that how can you have nuance when we have a threat of Trump coming back? When we have idiots.
What a great point.
We have Katie Britt and Marjorie Taylor Greene in this world. How can we have nuance? How can we actually say something? So as an artist, it's very frustrating to me. I don't want to just live in a space of telling gay stories that are like, gay people deserve to exist too. Gay people should, like, yes, I agree, but also snore creatively. Like, as a human being, yes, absolutely. But it's very hard. It's very hard to sort of have to make us to really say something when people are, I'm sorry, just stupid. And like, and so we have to really just kind of go, oh, right. We have to really water this down. We have to really make this make sense and make this clear to people. And
well, it's interesting though, don't you think, because in keeping with that idea of, you know, having cultural space for nuance, I actually was chatting about this with a friend recently, and this kind of dovetails back into the movies nominated this year at the Oscars, which was, I actually was struck by how many very like quiet, nuanced films were even just generally a part of the awards conversation writ large.
Yes.
You know, Anatomy of a Fall, Past Lives, All of Us Strangers.
Zone of Interest. All of Us Strangers, but it was in the conversation, but it got zero.
True. Didn't get nominated, but a part of the conversation. And I actually think, like, I wonder if, because it also seems like we're getting so exhausted and we've just been sort of overly inundated by superhero movies, that now they're just, the cultural taste has changed and people now want to go back to these movies that actually, you know, you mentioned loving watching Silence of the Lambs sweep when you were a little kid. Like, I actually think this is probably the first time in 20 plus years where we might actually be entering an arena socially where a movie like that could not only get made today, but also be celebrated. I actually wonder if we're just about to turn this corner.
I hope you're right. I really hope you're right. Because I feel like, yes, it was exciting how many people loved Past Lives and Anatomy of a Fall this year. And you know, yes, All of Us Stranger was probably my favorite movie of last year. May, December was another one of my favorites from last
year. Yes. Oh my God.
This was a really amazing year for queer cinema, you know, and I was really inspired, and I have to talk about it again, but Dix the musical really inspired me.
It
was, to me, that was my Barbie. I'm sorry. Y'all can have Barbie. I'll take Dix the musical, because I think that movie has so much more to say about the patriarchy and about gender politics, and is actually funny and actually has songs that are memorable, you know, sorry, but I don't need to be the most popular. I don't need for the thing. I know that the thing is, you know, that what makes something good sometimes is the thing that only a few people know about it. You know, I mean, I understand that like the most mainstream thing, you know, wins, you know, and it's interesting, like what moment we're going through. I think it's good that, I think we should always have Marvel movies and action movies. And I think we should all have that. Mm-hmm. It's just that can't be everything. And it's
right. There needs to be a balance.
You know, and for those of us, like, you know, that don't ever see ourselves in those spaces as actors, writers anywhere, I'm like, I don't know what I would, I'd be thrilled if I was at a point in my career to be in a Marvel movie. I would happily do that. But
yeah,
as I'm making my way up, how does that even happen? And how does that even, you know, but am I excited about that creatively? No, financially, absolutely. But it's like,
I love, I don't know if you saw that pull quote from Kirsten Dunst when she was interviewed by, I want to say, I can't remember which magazine it was, but you know, she was asked like, oh, well, would you ever do a superhero film again? And she was like, yes, they pay a ton of money and yeah. I have two children and I support my adult mother. And you're like,
100%.
There it is. There it is.
And now, Kirsten Dunst is a real artist. She does like yes. really edgy, cool shit too. And it's also like, yeah, like that's the business. Like you go into this as a job, you also are like, this pays the bills, this feeds the soul. And rarely the twain shall meet. And that's how the business has been from day one. Rarely is there something that links up in that way. But I do think that, I hope you're right. Well, and I hope audiences want, you know, I just think, you know, what sucks is when we fall into the middle. And I do think Oppenheimer, it was not my favorite movie of the year last year or even, but I think as a Best Picture winner, I think it'll be one that will go down in history as like a groundbreaking film, a very well-made film. I really enjoyed it way more than I thought I would. And
there you go.
Not embarrassing. Whereas like the last couple are a bunch of Best Picture winners in years past, I've been like,
yes.
We've gone for the most mediocre, middle of the road, Coda, Green Book, Shape of Water. Like we went through, and we do that a lot. King's Speech, like they're movies that just kind of like, whatever, ew, gross, vomit, mayonnaise. Like that's what a lot of, because that's the ranking system at right. work, because people vote. And so the movie, the least hated movie wins Best Picture often, because it's kind of like, well, the ones that gets the most twos and threes usually wins, but usually a number one, a polarizing movie is, you know, that's like a masterpiece. A lot of other people hate enough and the ranking system doesn't make it so that it can win.
Oh, interesting. Well, I do want to talk about your second pop culture pull, because I think actually this is, as you were chatting about this idea of like, how do we find balance between art and commerce? I think actually the second person you want to talk about is someone who's had to navigate this her entire career.
Yes.
And we've discussed her in different iterations on the show before, but never as sort of just the broad entity that is her. I am talking, of course, about Madonna.
Madonna.
Madonna. Now, let me ask you this. You first became of her when? Do you remember when she first like kind of struck you?
I mean, I have to say, I feel like all my life. I mean, I was so the album came out in her first album came out in 83.
Yeah,
I would have been 6 years old, so I don't think I was that tapped in with the New York. I don't think I was listening to Holiday.
No?
I mean, I was probably roller skating to it a few years later. So it definitely would have been. Material Girl, Like a Virgin.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, since my awareness, Madonna has been in my life, and
she factors so largely in your life and means so much to you. Why? Because I definitely know why she means a lot to me, but I'm curious to know what her pull is with you.
She, as a kid, I mean, I did love her music. Also, she pissed off my parents. Mm-hmm. Also, I thought she was sexy. I thought she was outrageous. Truth or Dare was the first black and white movie I saw in a movie theater in Lincolnton, North Carolina. And I was like, in our small town, we got a black and white movie. And I saw a documentary in the theater. And I remember being like, Truth or Dare was so outrageous when I saw it. And, you know, she just always has been part of the zeitgeist. What I always loved growing up is that she would always change her whole identity, yet always maintain Madonna. She stayed in that. And, but I mean, Blonde Ambition was the greatest and Vogue. And then I feel like I went through this long period for probably the last 10 years where I was like, so turned off by her. I found out I was ugh, she's lost it. And now she's back and I'm a fan again. So
I don't think it's just you. I think, you know, it's a very interesting thing, and this is, you know, territory that's been explored, I believe, on the show. But, you know, one thing that I sort of always found so maddening about Madonna is that I think along the way in the last like 10, 15 years, I think she actually forgot the power she wields.
Mm.
And she forgot that she was already holding the world in the palm of her hand, and we were going to move in whichever direction she pointed us in. And it seemed to me that there was this pivot that all of a sudden really started to take place, primarily after Confessions of a Dance Floor, where it looked like now more than ever, she was really trying to sort of like, at a breakneck pace, sort of assess what the cultural landscape is. And instead of trying to shape it, she was just trying to plug herself in.
Yes.
And then it's like, okay, what's the sound that's happening right now? Okay, what's the, who are the hot producers that I should be working with? Who are the hot singers that should be featured on this song? And then it almost felt like that kind of career dip, if you want to call it, then also started to parallel this personality shift. Because, you know, what was interesting about Madonna, particularly going into the late 90s and early aughts, is that she seemed the most settled and at peace with herself she had ever been in her entire life. And it really felt like she'd kind of really matured into like,
you're talking about like Ray of Light time or
yeah. And feeling like, you know, she was this sort of like, I don't know, and I mean this affectionately, but like she was embracing her like elder stateswoman position in pop music. Mm-hmm. And then it's like that then started to falter because I think she just got freaked out by the fact that she was getting older. And then just watching her sort of like panic and trying to, like, it's funny you bring up this idea of reinvention. It's like this is the first time she's reinvented herself into something that the public really decidedly did not want, which was like, right, this kind of like cringy middle-aged woman on Instagram who was really starting to look so much not like herself and was really, seemed like there was something afoot going on. And so there was, you're absolutely right. This like roller coaster, I think, of public opinion with her. And granted, there has been her entire career. I echo that sentiment that I had also sort of been like struggling with my own feelings of like, do I love Madonna? Do I not love Madonna?
Right.
And, you know, now she's like quite literally back from the brink of death on this Celebration, yes, tour. Have you seen it?
I saw it last week.
Tell me everything.
It's phenomenal. It's truly one of the greatest. I've never seen a more confident performer in my life. That was so great to see her just own it. Also, just like the history, you mm-hmm. know, just the like almost how it's like this documentary style, how you get this little sense of her stories. Mm-hmm. It was so exciting. It also was so moving. I was sobbing. She does this AIDS tribute that is, you know, with Live to Tell, that is so beautiful that, you know, this is the second time, the second concert I've seen. I saw MDNA in 2012, and that was also an incredible concert. I love the storytelling she does in her concerts and how you really get this sense. But this really did feel like, you know, for those of us that love her, we kind of were like, oh my God, I remember this moment with you. I remember this moment in the world. And I remember how you were so involved in these moments. But it just scratches so many itches, and you have the, you know, the incredible Bob the drag queen throughout the show, who gives an amazing, like, you know,
incredible MC
character.
Yes.
Yeah, it was just like the entire thing was, you know, and it got very, it went through these kind of places where it got very zen and it got very quiet. Some people said they felt the energy went down when they at moments in it, but I felt that was all intentional. And also, to your point, I'm glad she wasn't trying to jump around and act like, you know, Taylor Swift now, because it's like, no, I'm 65 years old. I'm Madonna. I'm going to tell you what's up, and you're going to just enjoy what you're getting. And I thought it was just an incredible experience. And it was the vibe. Everyone that was working at, I've got to give a shout out to the Kia Forum in Inglewood, California. Everyone working there was so happy. The people selling merch, the people selling drinks, the crowd was like, people were talking to each other before. We were talking to fans. It was a lot of older people, but a lot of younger people too. And everybody was just in a good mood when we were there. And I think it was that thing of like, oh, we, you know, it's pepperoni pizza in a way too. It's like, we all love this flavor.
Yes.
And so, I don't know. It was very comforting and exciting and moving. And
well, one thing the question I have about that show, which, and I wish someone would ask her about, but you know, one theme that does play very prominently in that show is death. the, yes. you know, it, the death of her mother, the death of this entire generation of people that we lost to the AIDS crisis. And then of course, you know, her own, you know, sort of episode, health episode last year where, yeah, you know, she right. says she basically came from the brink of death. Right. And I would be so curious to know if this through line of death and sort of, you know, riding that wave of grief, love and heartbreak and all of that, I'd be so curious to know if that was already at play prior to this, you know, health episode that she had, or if that was something that then sort of reared its head and then she then implemented. I mean, it's quite possible just with respects to logistics, you know, that show was locked a long time ago and maybe that was always there, but it's kind of impossible to not draw the parallel between so much of what she's walking us through with respects to her past, right? And this right. incredible loss that she and all of us have, you know, experienced throughout our lives. And then for her to also be very, in a very, very intimate way, having reckoned with her own mortality. I mean, I just, that was also, I think, for me, with those moments, especially really ramped up how profound it was.
With great art, and sometimes it's incredibly cruel. It's a cruel reality of like, you really, you know, her sort of, you know, we can talk in the past of the last few years of her vanity of it, worrying about getting older and yeah. how we kind of lost sense. We lost sort of, you know, the interest because it's like, oh, so what? You're getting older. Everyone's getting older, right? We don't care. But when you actually face death, there's such an authenticity that comes through when you're actually dealing with stuff and you're like, oh no, this is real.
Yeah.
So like getting older and oh boy, I look differently now. Oh, okay. Yeah. Welcome to that's just the human experience. But when it's something like that, it does inform your work. And that's why, you know, when you really listen to what's happening and you create from that space, it's so much more interesting. And we all immediately identify with it more than listening to out here and going, what's cool? What's interesting? What do we got to do? What do I got to face?
Right,
you're flailing and you're chasing and you're grabbing for something that's not, you know, when you're really chasing the zeitgeist, you're behind it always. And it's why, you know, this business is what it is. You know, we'll see like, oh, this movie was a hit. So you'll see why, you know, I was teaching class the other day and they were asking, we were talking about this movie, Jack Frost with, Michael Keaton?
Yeah.
Where he becomes a snowman. He like becomes a snowman.
Yes.
And this class was like, what is this? And I said, you guys, I said, Mrs. Doubtfire was a huge hit. And Hollywood was doing everything they could to be like, what's next? And so they made Michael Keaton a snowman. I mean, that's how the business works. Like this works. So let's make this thing. And so, but when you're just like, oh, I'm actually experienced this and I'm coming from this place, we immediately go, we lean in and we go, oh, wow. Because it was, I didn't know, I sort of fell off. I didn't know the song about her mother. It was so beautiful. That was one song in the whole concert that I didn't know because that was on her album,
American
Rebel
Life.
Heart?
American no, Life. No, it was okay. American Life, yeah.
American
mother,
Life. Okay, see,
mother
those albums
father.
I don't know well. And so my friend Pete, who is the world's biggest Madonna fan, was explaining that to me as we were going. He was like, oh yeah, this is from that. And I was like, this song is incredible. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, it's like something that you know, it's just always the goal. It's like, it sucks to write or to live through those experiences. But when you come out on the other end of it, it's like, yeah, that's how actually the good stuff happens. When you actually have it.
And when you talk about, the way that also, you know, life or art rather sort of tends to have, I think, more of a profound effect when you're drawing from your personal life. I mean, I would imagine for someone who has a career that where they are in a way all constantly under the gun to create, right? Because the record company wants their next hit record. They want their next hit single. They want their next big smash music video. They want their big smash tour. You know, I wonder about people who have that pressure of deadline and actually if maybe that's why they find themselves kind of looking outwards at a certain point to kind of be like, okay, well, what's everyone else doing?
Well, you haven't had a life. Like you haven't had a perspective.
And also, when you are pulling from yourself, like there is such a thing as tapping the well out a little bit. And then you, what you're saying, then it totally applies, which is like, yeah. And then you need to actually go out and live a life to be able to like fill it back up. But I think that must be such an incredible thing to have to navigate of like, how do you turn yourself inside out all the time? Like that's kind of, you can't.
And so many, I think why so many biopics can be dull is that because people's work is their life. Like they, right. A lot of the stories are the same story. It's like, you know, they didn't really have much of a, like they don't have nearly as interesting a story as a regular human being who actually went through a much more interesting life than a major artist who was always on tour and always making and in the studio and, you know, and on these lovely trips and being and at award shows and being loved. And like, when did they ever have anything happen to them that we can relate to?
You know? Is there a biopic that stands out that you think is sort of like leaps and bounds above the rest?
You know what I always go to, and it's one that like didn't do very well, and I love it, is Get On Up, the James Brown biopic.
Oh,
I think
Andre 3000.
I think it's so well done. I think it really captures the spirit of his music. It's not chronological. I love it. I also love What's Love Got to Do with It. I think that's a classic.
That's a classic. Also, one that I would throw on there just for good measure, I would throw up Marion Cotillard as Edith Piaf in La Vie en Rose.
Oh, yeah. Well, that movie made me hate Edith Piaf. I don't think Edith Piaf was a good person, but yeah.
I will say it didn't make me hate her. I mean,
that's not a slam on the movie. I think that's just, you know, artists are who they are, but I did watch it and go, you know.
She would have been tough. Listen, when you're a person who like comes from nothing, when you kind of have not really been like properly socialized.
Well, I'm Madonna too.
But I'm talking about like, you know, when you're like basically a Parisian street urchin, like there is just quite a crucial part of your brain and self that isn't socialized.
Yes.
So then when you're like thrown onto the world stage, you're like, I don't have any fucking coping mechanisms.
Of course.
So like, I'm freaking the fuck out. Yeah, I'm going to be addicted to fucking like methadone or whatever the hell she was like whatever her thing
Log
was. Like,
or whatever. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I mean, yeah, it's so like, of course, like, you know, of course that's going to be the end product or the you know, the end result.
Of course.
Now, do you, because I will say, like, one question that I always have for Madonna fans, because I think, you know, she is a woman who's constantly reinventing herself, and she is someone who's seen so many different, I mean, to I suppose now pull a word from the Taylor Swift zeitgeist, you know, so many different eras of her image and her life and of her career. But like, if we could prognosticate, and even if we could sort of like work a little magic, if you could take your pick of what you would love to see next for Madonna, if it was like blue sky thinking, whatever you say would manifest, is there something that you personally would love for her with respect to her career? Like, you want to see her do this kind of thing, whatever that thing is.
Oh, I don't know. You know, I don't know what she hasn't already accomplished.
You know, what I would love, and maybe this can help like inform an answer for you, or, you know, cause like, I always thought it'd be so cool if she kind of like worked with like a really interesting sort of ingenious, like indie pop producer, like in the vein of a Blood Orange, in the vein of maybe someone who produces records for that group, you know, The War on Drugs or Wise Blood or any of these like new fantastic people coming up now, like a Mitski. Like, I would love to see Madonna do like her indie art pop record.
Mm.
That's what I would love for her.
That would be, I mean, I would, that would be really, that'd be exciting. I also wonder if, like, you know, if she would ever like her take on standards or on like, I don't know, diva, like show tune numbers or something, like, cause I think her take on stuff is always interesting. She reinvented some of her songs, like in her concert, her like reboot of Burn It Up was hot.
Mm.
And that's one of my favorite songs of her of all time. I love that song, but the way she did it in the concert, I was like, she's great at just like taking her stuff and just kind of, you know, and just reconfiguring them for like, oh, I have a different story to tell with these same words in the same song. Like, she's very good at that.
I'm only just piecing this together. Did you see Madonna when she brought Kylie Minogue up on stage?
No, I didn't see it that night. Kylie only went one night, and I was not there the night that Kylie was there. No. But that would have been incredible. I do love Kylie too.
Speaking of sliding out of your damn seat, I don't care that I'm gay. I would have every single orifice on my body that could secrete a fluid. It would have happened.
No, that's because you're gay.
Oh, right, right.
It's right. Kylie and Madonna. It can doesn't right. get gayer than that.
That's right. That's right. Now, I want to talk to you about your third pop culture pull here. And this is a woman who, I mean, speaking of someone who like deserves their fucking flowers, she's totally like, she's a Hollywood legend. A lot of audiences probably know her largely from having a starring role on Black-ish, but you want to talk about the supreme diva that is Ms. Jennifer Lewis.
Yes, the mother of Black Hollywood.
Now, you, if I'm not mistaken, did have a encounter with her, did you not, backstage?
Yes, I have been lucky enough to meet her twice, and just like, she's just wonderful and incredible, as you know, would expect. She just came and saw, I was in Titanic, this musical parody of Titanic with Celine Dion. I was doing that this in New York, and she came and saw the show. And
had so many wonderful things, so many wonderful things to say about the show in that clip. It was so touching. So she comes backstage and she sees you in Titanic.
So yes, she came and saw the show and made a point to come up to every person in the show and find something lovely to say to each one of them. And it was just like having her, we also have a reference in Titanic to Jackie's Back, which is a movie that she made in 1999, which is a classic.
Yes.
We have a line in the show that my character said that was a direct shout out to Jennifer Lewis. And you're always, you know, in the moment, a little bit terrified to do the thing in front of the person.
Yeah. And especially Jennifer Lewis, like, let's be real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, cause you want Jennifer Lewis to like you. I mean,
of course,
there's certain people that I'm like, I don't really care. It's cool if it's there, you know, but you also just don't ever know how it's going to land with somebody if they kind of are just not in the space to have themselves pointed out. And I've done a lot of parody shows, and sometimes the people from the movie or the people from the TV show that we're parodying show up. And sometimes the people I'm playing, the actor is there in the audience. And it's just always a little bit like, I have to forget. That makes me more nervous than anybody else there, because I just want to make sure they're being taken care of. I know the audience is watching them watch the show, you know, but the general, it was just a one line thing, but still I was like, I hope, you know, that she was cool with it. She really loved it, and she was just really wonderful about that. But she told us that night when we were there the story that she just told to Robin Roberts on TV about. Now, do you know about this? What, just because it just happened?
I know. So, but please fill everyone in.
She was on safari in Rwanda. She was in the Serengeti. Sure,
I think so. I think so.
Yeah. Staying at this hotel, and when the lights were out, it was just completely pitch black at night, and she went out to look at her infinity pool, and there was an area that was not marked with no signs, and she fell 10 feet into the sand where there were rocks all around her. She couldn't move. She had knocked out of her. I think she bruised. She broke her leg. She broke, like, bones.
Yeah.
And as she was passing out from the pain, she heard a lion roar, because she's in the Serengeti. So she told us this story, and she was just kind of telling the story that she had been in rehab for like 6 months, and she was in amazing shape. She was doing high kicks. She
looked amazing.
And so she told us this whole thing to basically say, like, you know, and she was like, yeah, she goes, my last thought as I was passing out, I heard this lion roar, and I thought, the queen of the jungle is gonna eat the queen of Black Hollywood. She goes, what a headline. And, you know, which is what she said to Robin Roberts, you know, on her thing. And it's just like, my God, what an icon. Because she's literally played everyone's mother. Speaking of What's Love Got to Do with It, she plays Tina Turner's mother in that.
Oh,
she's
my God.
She's the preacher's wife. I mean, you know, she's, you know, everything. That show, oh my God, I love this show. I love that for you.
I love that for you. I know. So mercilessly canceled too soon.
Brilliant show. Well, it's too smart. Again, it was just, I think it was a show that was too many layers going on in it. And I loved that the people were kind of awful people. And yeah. she played kind of an awful woman that you just, you wept for, you know, that you were really totally invested in.
And I actually come from a long line of upholsterers.
Joanna, we'll go with the cancer. We're going to do everything we can to make you comfortable. Maybe you need a bigger dressing room. We could always swap her out with Beth Ann.
What?
You got a problem with that?
No, I think, yeah. Give her Beth Ann's room, because it's bigger.
Yep, that's not necessary.
All right, Darcy, make sure she's taken care of.
Yes.
I don't know. I just wanted to give her a shout out on this. I'd be like, more of us need to be talking about her and grateful for her. And
yeah.
My God. Also, just like a character actor. She's been, since she was very young, she was playing mothers.
I know.
She was like 5 years older than the person that whose mother she played. And she's always been that character actor. And it's like very inspiring to those of us who have known all of our lives. That's who we were too. And we're like, oh,
yeah.
More love for this character actor, please. Because I just adore her. And I'm so grateful that she's okay.
Yes. I mean, listen, for people who haven't seen that interview, I mean, I'm sure even just the description of the accident, you know, says it right there. But I mean, if without knowing the end result, if you just described that accident to someone, you would naturally assume, like, the next question I would ask is, and when was the service? Like, that right. is not an accident that someone you would think would emerge alive from. And also, let's just be real, also not someone who's like a little bit older, maybe yeah. a little, you know what I mean? Like, and so the fact that she is upright, walking, talking, kicking, dancing, singing, like it, that is a fucking miracle. That's incredible. That's fucking incredible. And I agree. Yeah. I think she is a person who, you know, for everyone listening at home, one of the whole reasons why we love doing the show is because, you know, we want to be able to not only share things that are personal to us, but also maybe help provide and give a recommendation to someone. And so, like, if you're not familiar with Jennifer Lewis and all that she can do and has done and will continue to do, like, this is absolutely the time to sort of, you know, go and make that investment for yourself.
Yes.
Now, I want to talk to you about this, and then I promise I will let you go, because we teased this a little bit towards the top of your interview here, but you have written this play that I have to tell you, because you're conducting these readings and I'm hearing nothing but incredible things, Drew. This is being received so warmly. Tell us also, because I want you to be the one to say it, please share the name of your play.
It's called Messy White Gaze.
Thank you.
And yes, it starts with a murder. It's about a throuple in Hell's Kitchen on a Sunday morning. Two guys who are killing their third, and they shove his body into a Jonathan Adler credenza. And then other gays come over for brunch. So there's a dead body in the room. And it's really about how, as gays, we dispose of each other very quickly. I also wanted to make a point that they were all white, and I wanted to talk about our problematic relationship with race as gay white men, and how we think we're on the right side of history. And we usually intend to be on the right side, but we don't really have any friends of color. We don't really have any female or trans friends. We are only, you know, we sort of become our own sort of subculture in that way.
Yeah.
It comes from my anger about what's happening in this country about race relations. And I don't know how else to talk about it without putting us on the hook and being part of the problem and not saying that, you know, otherwise I've always loved to sort of, you know, do work within the community. I'm not really interested in yelling at straight people to accept us and understand us as much as I am. Like, we need to love each other more and love ourselves and take care of each other more.
Yes.
And we have privilege, even though, yes, we are gay, we are white men, and we have a privilege that so many other people don't have that are in our community. And for us to claim that we understand the entire minority experience is so gross and so upsetting and problematic. And so, you know, I wanted to just make a show where everyone is awful. I mean, all five of these people are terrible people. So it's very fun to do. It's 90 minutes of just terrible people being terrible to each other. And the readings have gone really well. We're doing four readings in April, the 7th, 8th, and 9th at Soho Playhouse in New York.
Oh.
And so if anyone, I'm not sure when this is going to air.
No, this will be out in time for people to get themselves organized to make that happen. So yes.
It's messywhitegaze.com. They can go and visit the site and get tickets there if you're in New York and want to see. We have an amazing cast to do this. And we're just trying to raise money to do a production. We really want to do a full-scale production and get to do this somewhere. Because it was just a passion project that I was working on in between, you know, waiting for the phone to ring and, you know, during the strike and sort of being like, yeah, all right, film and TV work is not, I know. So I was very lucky to get to do Titanic in New York and then get to work on this play, get to just keep theater going and to just say something. I'm tired of feeling like seeing my own opinions given back to me every time I go and see something. And I'm like, this is something that I'm like, I want to shake things up and have a conversation and sort of, you know, so that's been really fun to be, you know, get to do that. So hopefully we'll do more.
And also, I just have to say, you know, also just as your friend, it's so wonderful to see you in, you know, yet another thing and another thing that you've created that's being so celebrated and people are so excited about. And, you know, for people listening at home, I mean, not only do we want you to go check out that website that Drew mentioned, but also for people who want to be up to date with you and everything else that you're doing, you're at Drew Droege on socials. Yes.
Yes. My Instagram is at Drew_Droege.
Boom.
You'll find it. You'll find
Listen,
it.
Listen, here's what we can count on. Open your Google, everyone. And if you copy and paste the guest name from your podcast app into that search bar, I promise you incredible things are going to happen.
Yeah.
Incredible. You're going to be linked to so many wonderful resources.
Congrats, you opened your Google.
I mean, that's really all we can ask for. Mm-hmm. I have to also thank you so much for doing this. I love chatting with you. It's always nice seeing you.
I love chatting with you. Thank you so much for having me, Liam. Thanks for having me.
And also, not for nothing, I'm going to be in LA soon, and it'd be wonderful to see you.
Yes, let's get lunch. Cocktails,
okay, good.
All of it. Yes, please. Done.
Well, thank you, Mr. Drew.
Thank you, Mr. Grow.
My thanks to the wonderful Drew Droege. You can follow him on socials. You should go to his website and make sure that you're keeping up to date with Messy White Gaze to figure out when the next reading is happening. Also, grab those tickets for those April dates. That's very important. We want to support our beloved Drew. And listen, while you're in a supporting and supportive mood, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to this show. 5 stars only. Throw a comment on there. Be sure to pop over to our show's Instagram page and follow us there at Tell Liam Everything. And also, tellliameverything@gmail.com if you want to reach out to us directly there too. And listen, as always, our gorgeous guests leave us with their pop culture pulls, and I'm going to share one of mine. And this is actually tying into something that I'll be doing very soon at the top of April. I don't know entirely when it's going to air, but I'll tease more of it if you keep up to date with our Instagram page. I am going to be appearing on a Fabulous Woman's podcast. Again, teasing, spoiling, hello. And I will be chatting all about Linda Ronstadt's first memoir called Simple Dreams. And that is my pop culture pick for this week. If you would like to learn more about this real Renaissance woman singer and everything that she contributed to music, and particularly the way that she shaped the industry in the 70s and 80s, it's a wonderful read. It is such an interesting and insightful look into her process. The book again is called Linda Ronstadt, Simple Dreams, and that's my pick for you this week. As always, thank you for listening. We'll be back so soon. I mean, my God, Blinken will be there. And until next time, we will see you then, and I hope you take care of yourselves.